I Want More Comics podcast special edition. I'm Keith.
I'm Eric.
I'm Lee.
And we're here today with a special edition that's a magic-focused show. Typically, our other podcasts we've done so far with this have been driven about comic-related material. We also are a gaming store, and so because of that, we're not going to ignore what's going on in the gaming world. And there's a pretty big set coming out this weekend that's called Eternal Masters. And so for anybody who's really, really only interested in the comic stuff, sure, this special episode is probably not for you. We're still doing the normal episode this week, and you can catch that. But if you ever had any kind of curiosity about what goes on with magic and gaming, this episode should cover some of that. And also, if you're playing really into what's going on with the Eternal Masters format, we're going to cover that set today. So kind of starting us off with magic and all this, I've brought in Eric Whedon and Lee Marino to kind of chat with us here. So Lee, tell us a little bit about your magic experience and background.
I've been playing Magic for 4 or 5 years. Started playing the game on Xbox Live Arcade. Just kind of fell in love with it. Spent a lot of time playing with it. Stumbled into I Want More Comics. Bought some starter packs. Played with my roommates and friends. Eventually, it became more competitive at the game. I've qualified for 3 Pro Tours now. And done pretty well in some other events. Grand Prix, Star City Open, stuff like that. I just love the game. And I love playing the game competitively now, even though the game's still a lot of fun too. And this set looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. There's a lot of really cool cards and some really tough to find cards too. So that's really exciting. I think it's going to increase the accessibility for a lot of players to get into some of these formats that are a lot of fun, like Legacy and Modern and stuff like that too. So that's a little about me.
Eric, how about you? How long have you played the game?
14 years now. Started in 2002 with a set called Odyssey. Been playing competitively since about a year into that. It's about 2003 I started playing Pro Tour qualifiers and things like that. I played in 1 Pro Tour in Madrid and been playing kind of all around the country since I started getting into the competitive scene.
Well, and you guys have both talked about competitive here, but Magic kind of expands out all levels of play. And at the store, we see a lot of people from a lot of different areas. There are plenty of people who play at home, play just the kitchen top level. We actually do recommend out, as Lee mentioned, the online game of Duel of the Planeswalkers, now called, I believe, Magic Duels is what the game is digitally now. It's a great experience to be able to play the game, see some of the basic level of it, see even some of the advanced level of some of the cards into it, without having to invest a ton of money into trying it out and seeing what you're at. When we talk about competitive, I know Eric and Lee, because we turn around and go around to a lot of the regional tournaments here and have even flown all over the U.S. to play in some of the Grand Prix, or what they're called, higher level tournaments that can have anywhere from, you know, on the low end nowadays, it's only like 1,200 players. But we were all out at Vegas where there was 9,000 players playing out there last year for the big set. So a competitive level tournament like that involves, you know, a little bit more hardcore on the rules, about staying a little bit more consistent with what's going on. That's what changes around. And this set is designed a little bit more for that competitive player. Eternal Masters is coming out with pack price that's much higher than what a normal pack would be, and includes quite a bit of reprinted cards from the format of Legacy. And I know
Vintage as well.
Vintage cards as well. So we've played, it's not necessarily the focus of a lot of people, because as Lee brought up, accessibility of some of the cards has been a problem. So Eternal Masters being printing may solve quite a bit of some of these cards becoming available. We're going to talk about some of the higher power level cards inside this, but Magic as a game has been going pretty strong here for 23 years, and this set is focused on printing cards that are mostly have been out of print or not quite as available, that go back all the way to the dawn of Magic. So looking at the set, looking at the expense of this set, Eric, what are you kind of expecting in the way of looking at this, if you were just, say, opening up packs, you know, chasing cards out of this?
I mean, if you look at the financial breakdown, there are something like 25 of the rares and mythics, of which there's one per pack, that are going to get you at least your money back, if not double, triple, quadruple your money, all the way up to there's a card called Mana Crypt, which is all the way back to the inception of Magic, and right now those are going for almost $130. So, you know, you pay your $10 to buy a pack and you can crack and really gain a lot of value there, which is not something you can usually do with your modern day Magic sets that are available for people to play with, that come out every 3 months, that your regular sets, where, you know, you'll buy a pack for $4 and you'll open up, you know, at the very best you might be looking $30-$50. So the return on your investment can be significantly higher with Eternal Masters.
Well, and Lee, looking at what you've played in inside Legacy here, what kind of cards stick out of this set, you know, on the value side? Because we're kind of going to break up this conversation into, you know, what the set's doing value-wise in the world and all this, and then later we're going to talk about specifically how you'd play it inside of a tournament. But value side, Lee, what are you thinking about this? Where's your feelings?
In terms of getting into Legacy, I think it's great because there's a lot of these cards that, like you said previously, haven't been printed for a number of years, and they're tough to find. I mean, Force of Will, Wasteland, Sneak Attack, even something like Sensei's Divining Top, which is an uncommon, is really tough to find. And if you're trying to find a couple of these cards to get into Legacy, or maybe, you know, maybe you have Wastelands and you're just looking for a couple of these rares, or maybe you have Ancient Tombs and you're looking for a couple filler slots for your Legacy deck. But I think the release of the set is really great because it allows you to get a couple of these cards that are maybe a little tougher to find at your local game store. I want more comics. Some of them just aren't in circulation. A lot of players aren't really willing to trade or part with a lot of them. I mean, Eric, what do you think? You've been playing a while. Do you see these cards in trade binders? Are they tough to find?
Yeah, the thing you mentioned, Sensei's Divining Top, which, as you said, is an uncommon. You don't see those anymore. You know, they weren't worth very much when they were initially printed, probably a dozen years ago or so at this point. And they've since risen to prominence in a lot of decks of older formats. So even being an uncommon, the price has really shot up on those. Two things to note about this. First, as I mentioned, there are a lot of really pricey rares, which you get one per pack. There are a lot of pricey uncommons, which you get three per pack as well, which is going to make those a little bit more accessible, might drive the price down a little bit, at least on these printings. The original printings still hold a lot of value for collectors, but on these printings, they'll be a little bit more accessible to get your $5, $6, $7 uncommons, since you'll see a lot more of those in your pack. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting is, at least Legacy, and maybe even a little bit more so Vintage, but specific to Legacy, at least in my experience, is people, given the cost of cards, people will find a deck that they like. They'll spend, you know, a large amount of money to acquire the cards for that deck, and that will be the deck that they play. Something that, you know, for people that are already involved in Legacy, this might be a way for them to maybe get a second deck or expand their collection to the point where they can maybe do a little bit more varied things, as opposed to just kind of getting one thing and doing that one thing, where you see in, you know, Standard, which is a format of the most recent sets, since the cards are significantly less expensive and significantly easier to find, people can kind of switch around as their tastes change and continue to evolve in that way. And maybe this might open up that door, you know, at least a little bit for Legacy players as well.
We kind of are walking the tightrope on this podcast of talking to people who may know little about Magic to people who are very experienced with Magic. And so to give you the quick and dirty for those who may not know everything we're talking about here, Magic is defined by the tournaments that you play in, and they're called different formats. So when we say things like standard, modern, legacy, and vintage, what it means is that standard is the most recent sets, typically the most recent 5 or 6 sets, depending on when the rotation is. Those cards that have been printed only in those sets are what are legal to be played inside those tournaments. Then you step backwards into modern. Modern gives you everything that was in print since 8th edition, which is approximately about 2001, forward, everything inside there with a banned list of cards. Legacy, which again, this Eternal Masters really starts focusing on, is everything that was ever printed in Magic with a specific banned list. The cards that are on the banned list cannot be played in those tournaments. Whereas Vintage covers everything again, but allows you a restricted list. So the cards that are restricted, you're allowed to only play one of inside of a deck. So that's the quick and dirty to just kind of keep you up to date with some of the lingo that we're using here to talk about this. I've played Legacy. I have my own deck. I like playing Rug Delver. I am kind of what Eric would say there, where I'm a guy who has one deck inside this because the decks can be pricey. Moving into something along these lines, I can pick up additional cards that are available that allow me to start replacing it out. Like inside my you know deck that I play, Force of Will is one of the prominent reprints in this. It was the first card that was announced to be reprinted inside this prior to this set. They were hanging and floating anywhere from $80 to $110 depending on the day. Now with the new set coming around, before this is even out on the market, people are looking at Force of Wills out of this set, are still hanging around that area, you know, of price wise, but there's going to be quite a bit more of them on the market to move into people's hands to be able to create this. Part of the balance will also be seeing stores supporting the format with additional tournaments, and that's where something, because of Eternal Masters, I Want More Comics is moving to running legacy tournaments 2 Fridays a month now instead of just the one that we were doing, trying to support this because we think that this is something that Wizards does well in getting additional cards out there and available for everyone. So I think when we talk about value, that's it seems really not necessarily completely top-heavy, because there are, like you said, $120 cards in here, $80 cards in here, pretty good. There are some times where you hit a card that's only worth a dollar or two inside that area. But when you fill it out, like Eric said, with some of the uncommons, your pack value can kind of get up from there. But one of the designs that they've been doing on a lot of these tournaments is to be moving into that although you can buy the packs and have the cards, they're designed to be played. They're designed to be played in limited format. So as opposed to any of those constructed formats where you turn around and bring your own deck, a limited tournament, you show up, you buy your entry fee in, you get X amount of packs, and you're going to make decks out of that. And the preliminary Tour qualifier that I Want More Comics is going to be running this Saturday on the 11th of June focuses on a sealed deck where you're going to get 6 packs of this. You get that many cards and you're going to be left in an environment where you build a deck just straight out of this. First blush, guys, where is this? Is this looking really strong for that? Is this looking interesting? What are you guys thinking?
Interesting is certainly a word you could use. This set, given that it's a set of all reprints and a set where they tried to incorporate a lot of more obscure, harder to find, more expensive cards, it feels a little less cohesive to me than your average set, which is designed for good constructed and good limited play. This one's certainly a little bit more of a niche set. They did this similar type of thing with a set called Modern Masters, which of course focuses more on cards from 2001 up, from 8th edition forward. And that was actually a really great limited environment, which it may not have looked like it would be on the surface. So perhaps after playing with this a little bit more, it'll feel more fluid and feel a little bit, I'll get more of a clear picture. You know, we've seen some of the baseline archetypes that are supported, and perhaps there are some more to be discovered and some that that look like they may not be fully fleshed out. You can maybe get easier than it seems at first blush, but it seems like more of a strange limited environment than you might typically play in.
Well, in looking at limited, and it breaks down into both sealed deck, where you start with six packs and you open them all up and you get to play with those cards, to a draft format where you're opening up one pack at a time in a circle of normally eight players, picking one card out, passing the pack, and building from there. Both you guys have had good success on the limited, even on the Pro Tour scale. Lee, one of your second qualifier to the Pro Tour was a limited tournament. Is that correct? So what do you look for, you know, not even in this set, but just in general when you're trying to build a limited deck?
In general, I think, you know, we're looking for rares. A lot of times, you know, for newer players, what us Magic players would refer to as bombs. Normally it's a rare, which is one of the cards. You only get one per your pack of six cards, like Keith was saying. But a lot of times this is going to be an extremely powerful card that will dominate a game of Magic, whether that's, you know, a really large flyer, whether that's a card that kills all the creatures on the board. It's normally a card that will swing a game in your favor. That's definitely something that you know, I will look for in a limited pool. Removal spells, I think, are also at a premium. That's going to be a spell that will kill an opposing creature or deal with an opposing bomb, kind of in the same vein. So we want to always kind of look and see what removal options are available in the format. I think that's what I'm looking for the most part with my pools, but I think I'm also looking to have fun. I mean, this is a great time, I think, to play Magic. I mean, Eternal Masters looks like a really fun set, because when else are you going to be able to play with a Chromox in Limited or Jace the Mind Sculptor in Limited? These are cards that a lot of players, you know, don't have access to, haven't seen, haven't played with. And I think, to me, it looks like a lot of fun. You know, Cabal Therapy, Green Sun Zenith, they're all just like really powerful cards. And in Limited, I think Sylvan Library, oh my goodness.
There are a couple of cards in this set that you can have fun with, and when you're playing them, something like Mana Crypt that I had mentioned earlier. It's a card that lets you accelerate your mana significantly faster than you would normally be able to. So if you're the one that's playing the Mana Crypt and accelerating your mana, you're going to probably have a lot of fun with that. If your opponent does it to you, you're not going to have as much fun with that. So certainly fun to be had by someone. Maybe not everyone.
Well, in a limited deck, you're building a 40-card deck. Very typical. Your, you know, split can be somewhere around like 23 spells, 17 lands, X amount of creatures. You know, we're usually looking for a higher count on creatures, guys, right? I mean, like 15-ish, you know?
14 to 17 creatures, maybe 6 to 8 removal or spells of some sort, tricks or enchantments.
Certainly that can change based on the specific deck that you're either drafting or putting together with your sealed pool. Some that we'll get into are going to be focusing significantly more on the spells than the creatures, just for the interactions that they have together.
Well, and then what's, you know, one of the things I always hear people talk about, especially when they're talking about higher level, is the curve. So, you know, when you're trying to build a deck, obviously, as you said, it'd be great if I had Mana Crypt, but it's a mythic rare inside this. If I'm able to play that out early and immediately get out to my spells that cost me 5, that seems great. Mm-hmm. But in a normal game, even if I have that in my deck, I may not see it right away and early in the game and all this. So what's curve mean?
Curve means that you want to be able to play a spell. You want to be able to use the mana that you have available to you most turns. Almost all turns. So while your higher cost cards are going to certainly be more impactful, if you don't start playing your cards until the fifth or the sixth turn, it's possible that your opponent's got you dead already. So you want to be able to get on the board a little bit sooner than that. So you want to play the most common mana cost in your deck. You're going to want to be 2 mana. You're going to want to play slightly less 3s, slightly less 4 mana cards, slightly less 5 mana cards, and maybe 1 or so 6 or 7 mana card, depending on the deck. If you have the ability to accelerate to them, you can certainly go a little bit heavier on the higher end. But there are some decks that focus so much on the lower end that they don't even play, you know, their 5 mana cards, because they're trying to get out so much faster than their opponent that it renders all their expensive cards irrelevant.
Well, and then looking just straight up, forget about how the synergies work with all the cards inside this. What would you be excited to openly to play? What would be one of those cards that you really want to start with a build around on, that you really find that obviously we're talking about those cards that are bombs, those impactful, you know, really ridiculously powered cards and all this. Like you mentioned, I haven't done this. Like, I started playing this stuff 2010. Since that point in time, I think I know of 1 to 5 cards in this entire set that have been printed in that period of time. So I haven't gotten to play this. But what are you seeing out there that you think would be, you know, that cool and probably put you in the right position to be playing long on the tournament?
Well, I got two answers, I guess. One would be that, like Eric said, I want to maybe have just a strong deck with a good curve, so that I can make, you know, 2 mana, 3 mana, 4 mana play out creatures and attack and try to put my opponent in a position where I can pressure their life total. In terms of deep down what I want to open, I guess, and play with is probably Sulfuric Vortex. If I could name one card, it'd probably be Sulfuric Vortex, because the first time I ever played Legacy, which was at I Want More Comics, I got introduced to Sulfuric Vortex, which is an enchantment that costs 2 red and 1. And every turn, it deals both players damage, and neither player can gain life.
Did you get introduced the hard way?
Well, no, I was playing it in my own Legacy deck the first time.
You introduced other people the hard way.
Yeah, yeah, but it's a really fun card, I think, just because it really puts a lot of pressure on your opponent. If you're a type of player that maybe you play Magic, maybe you don't, but maybe you will play other games where you like to be aggressive and you like to really put the pressure on your opponent. Sulfuric Vortex is a great card for that. Other cards maybe for that strategy, I mean, we've got Curdape. Who doesn't love Curdape? Curdape is a key part on the mana curve, like Eric said. You could play him for just 1 mana, and he's a good creature that can beat your opponent down pretty early. So that's something that's great about Curdape.
You're looking at an aggressive strategy.
Always. Yeah. Always if I can. always.
They're reprinting a card called Flinthoof Boar in this set, and I know that one is near and dear to Lee's heart.
That even has a nickname in our world. Good old Tasty Bacon.
Yeah. Or Hasty Bacon.
Or Hasty Bacon for his
value. Or Bakey Tastin. Yeah. Or any combination thereof. Keldon Marauders, another great aggressive card. Werebear. A little bit slower with Threshold, but I mean, I'm an aggressive player, so these are the things I'm looking for. There's obviously a lot of other ways to play the set. You know, Eric has a different range of decks and things that he's interested. Yeah. I'm wondering what he's kind of looked at so far in the set.
I'm pretty far the opposite way. I am usually not a fan of aggressive decks. I think that they're very good. I won't say that I don't like them because they're bad. They're certainly not bad. They're just not the way that I have the most fun playing Magic. So when I open my 6 packs, the kind of cards that I'm looking to open cost a lot of mana. I want the games to go long, and I want to play spells that are going to be so powerful that my opponent's going to struggle to deal with them, no matter how good their deck is. Probably towards the top of that list is a card called Duplicant. It's a colorless card, which means that no matter which colors I end up playing, Duplicant is almost always going to make my deck. So cards like that that are really powerful, but are always going to make your deck, are the kind of cards that are really, really nice to open. On the high power level scale that are going to fit in the decks that I'm going to enjoy playing, Jace the Mind Sculptor, one of the marquee cards from the set. Not only is it going to be really, really good in Limited, it's also going to be really, really good in my wallet once we're done with the tournament. So that'll be nice. Something like Maelstrom Wanderer is a card that can put you ridiculously far ahead. There's a lot of different things that fit my playstyle. Which is really nice because, like we just talked about, there's a lot of things that fit Lee's playstyle, and I think it really runs the gamut in between. If you want to be really aggressive and fast, if you want to be kind of going over the top of your opponent, and and playing these larger threats that cost more mana, or if you want to be in between, you know, closer to either side of the spectrum, I think there seems to be a lot that you can do in that whole range.
Yeah, whether you're into Chain Lightning, Curd Ape, and Price of Progress, or whether you're into
good cards,
Jace, Wrath of God, and Baleful Strix.
I just sure.
You gotta play Baleful Strix if you got him right.
I'll tell you, you're never gonna win a game by putting Brainstorm on an Isochron Scepter, but.
Define win.
But you get to have a lot of fun where your opponent watches you do a lot of things. You know, these are great parts there. I'm a little jaded on the set because one of my favorite cards is in it, but I don't think it's there, and that's Nimble Mongoose. Like, that guy seems
the
like
goose is loose.
The goose was great to play, but I don't know if there's enough of the low end that really gets this card out of hand real quickly. So here's Lee talking about aggressive cards. He's not mentioning Nimble Mongoose because I'm not sure it's completely there, is it?
I'm not sure about Nimble Mongoose, but I'd really want to make it work. I really want to try it. You do have ways to feed the graveyard in this set, so it's not a complete lost cause. I mean, in green, you have stuff like Commune with the Gods. You have Faithless Looting in red. So we don't have to give up on the goose just yet. The goose could still be loose.
I'm not calling him a bench card yet. But, yeah, you know,
fail or not, it will be tried.
Yeah, we're gonna try pretty much everything we can here with this set. It looks like it's gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah, some of the cards that you'll see in this set are nostalgic to people who played when they were standard legal back around the 2000s. Nimble Mongoose was a card that saw a lot of play because it gets better the more cards are in your graveyard, and that was something that was very easy to do because the set was kind of built around that. Now, Eternal Masters also has Nimble Mongoose, but is certainly less focused on filling your graveyard, so it's possible that the Mongoose won't be as impactful in this limited format as it was back when filling your graveyard was kind of incidental.
Well, it's funny because you look at, as you know, players and you know people that do this. Like, I look at Lee, and I know one of his decks he's played in Legacy has been Jund, and so there's the chance with some of those red cards that he mentioned that are there that could go right alongside a Deathrite Shaman, and just go to Crazy Town, you know, and have quite a bit of impact inside this. So there's a lot there, but let's talk archetypes. What are we, you know, archetypes almost seem to fit more when you're talking about draft strategies, because you're making the selection from almost a wider pool, because you're getting to see more packs, you're getting to see more cards. Yes, somebody ahead of you may be fighting for the same type of thing, but you usually can sculpt your deck a little bit better instead of, you know, kind of playing the ball where it lies, as you get sometimes inside sealed. So what, you know, archetypes, what strategies out there do you see that seem to be, you know, pretty well put together inside this format?
I think the one that jumps off the page to me is a strategy called Reanimator, where you're trying to put a really large creature in your graveyard and then cast any number of spells in the set that allow you to bring it from the graveyard directly into play, which is we refer to as cheating it into play. And so you can get a card that shouldn't be in play, you know, cost 7 mana. You can get it in play on the third turn, and it's going to be so much bigger than anything your opponent is doing when they're playing quote unquote fair, that you can just get out to such an early lead that something like that is going to win you the game kind of by itself. So, you know, there's cards like Sneak Attack that's not necessarily reanimation, but it does let you cheat a large creature into play. Natural Order lets you do that. Even down to the common and uncommon slot, there's things like Victimize, where you can sack one of your smaller creatures to bring back another creature. So there's a significant number of ways to put them back into play. And the original reanimation target, Regal Force, is in the set, so you can kind of start off on the right foot with that and get that guy into play even as soon as the second turn in this format. Your opponent is going to be really hard-pressed to come back from something like that. So that was the first archetype that jumped out to me in looking at the spoiler.
Well, and I saw Sphinx of the Steel win because I remember one of the very first...
That's too easy.
Yeah, my very first Legacy tournament, I lost a Reanimator on things like that. You know, Sphinx of the Steelwind and Iona coming out against me. Obviously, he's talked about an aggressive deck as an archetype and all this, but anything else you see out there that kind of jumps out that you think that there's enough in the set to really build around?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different things. One that we see that we're looking at a lot of is this, like, green-white. There's a lot of these different enchantment and payoff cards. I haven't personally played with a lot of these older ones, but I'm pretty excited to try a lot of it out. You know, we've got some commons and uncommons here. You know, so these are cards you're going to see in your draft. These are cards you're going to see in your sealed deck. You know, +1/+1 for each enchantment on the battlefield. +2/+2 for each other enchantment on the battlefield. We've got at the rare slot, you know, a creature that will let you draw a card when you play an enchantment. So if you get a bunch of these green and white kind of enchantment cards together, you can really go off, I guess, with it and make it crazy. We've got Enlightened Tutor in the set that can search for enchantment out of your deck. We have Faith's Fetters. which can gain you some life and shut down a creature. So this is an archetype that can really do a lot of different things, and you kind of have a lot of different utility. You can pump your own creatures, you can draw cards, you can shut down your opponent's creatures. It's in both green and white, and that is something that has a lot of synergy for me. We got Monk Idealist at common as well, which is when it enters the battlefield, you get to return an enchantment from your graveyard to your hand. And of course we have good old Pacifism. I mean, what's not to like about
classic
that's a classic classic card. Speaking of classic archetypes, this is one I'm sure Eric, who's been playing longer than I have and has probably played in a lot of draft formats, Blue-White Flyers.
Oh, yeah.
Flyers and Walls, right? I mean,
Sarah Angel's just good enough, isn't it, sometimes?
Yeah.
Every time.
I mean, so, Eric, I mean, you've been playing for a long time. I mean, and you've played in a lot of different limited formats. You're extensively experienced in a lot of different sets. I mean, when is Blue-White... What makes Blue-White so great? And when can you not play Blue-White? Can you just always play Blue-White? Blue-White's pretty much always good, right? Because Flyers are always good.
It's perennially draftable. It's not perennially good, though. More often than not, it's good. The thing about Blue-White is it's usually referred to as Blue-White Flyers, where your creatures have the ability Flying, which makes them significantly harder to block. They can only be blocked by creatures that also have Flying or have an ability called Reach, where they get to reach up into the sky and swat them down. But instead of, you know, all your stupid creatures running into each other on the ground, you can fly over the top of somebody else's creatures and attack their life total directly. The thing that is really exciting to me about Blue-White Flyers specific to this set is the card Squadron Hawk, the bane of many standard players' existence for the better part of 2 years. Very fun in limited as opposed to being incredibly annoying in standard. Squadron Hawk is a 1/1 flyer, but when it comes into play, you can search through your deck and find any number of other Squadron Hawks. So they all come together, and you can put them in your hand to be played later. So, you know, the more of these you draft, the more powerful this card becomes. You know, if it's drawing you 2, 3, 4 cards out of your deck at a clip, you know, it's something that can really kind of snowball out of control. As Lee mentioned, the walls portion is really important as well. So things like even Coalition Honor Guard is one of the more important ones. Wall of Omens, of course, amazing. You know, the more you can clog up the ground and keep your opponent's creatures at bay while you fly over the top of them, the more success you're going to have with, you know, not getting raced on the ground while your creatures, which are usually smaller than your opponents because they have flying. So you need to be able to kind of defend yourself a little bit while pecking over the top with your big birds.
Well, not to beat up the set, not to call it out for anything bad, but there does seem to be a couple archetypes in here that seem a little bit underrepresented. Usually a lot of sets I've seen in all this, you can find a tempo type deck, you know, a deck where you're playing, you know, you play out something early, then you're turning around and, you know, denying your opponent, you know, their plays, you're, you know, bouncing, controlling, whatever, and all that. It seems like I always remember in Blue Light Friars, if you get a little bit of tempo into it, you seem to have, you know, quite the advantage. Shadows over Innistrad had some pretty good tempo cards in that, which would bounce creatures, would do things like that. I'm not seeing a lot of that here.
No, definitely not. There's not so much of the unsummon effect as a general term. You know, you do have stuff like Man of War, which when it comes into play, it can return a creature to its owner's hand. You don't have too much in the way of that, where we have kind of a plethora of it and Shadows over Innistrad. But yeah, a little bit less of it here. So it certainly hurts the Flyers archetype, but maybe there's enough there still to get into it.
Well, and flipping it over and giving something I see way heavier in this format than I see in a lot of other formats and all this is tutoring, is the ability to go and get the card that you specifically want out of your deck instead of waiting to draw it. This set almost seems way more balanced towards tutoring up cards than even card advantage and drawing cards. Mm-hmm. So I see quite a bit there of being able to potentially, you know, play these high-end cards that you want to be able to play, you know, these bombs, but being able to get them quicker as opposed to waiting for them to show up inside your hand. Things like the, we got Mystical, Enlightened, Vampiric, even Gamble in red.
Yeah.
Natural Order. I don't know if you count that for green.
I would absolutely.
Green Sun Zenith.
Green Sun Zenith.
There's just.
It was interesting they put a Green Sun in instead of Worldly Tutor. But I actually don't think that's a bad thing. I think that was done pretty well for that.
Yeah, here's the thing about that is that Worldly Tutor, despite being part of the cycle of really powerful tutors, like you mentioned, Vampiric, Enlightened, Mystical, etc., those do see a lot of play in the older formats. Worldly Tutor does not. I think a lot because Green Sun Zenith kind of supplanted it.
Took that spot.
It's just
a little overshadowed.
More efficient.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of pieces there to be able to get into that. The flip side of this is what cards do you see out there that can be traps? That can be, oh, I really want to build with this card. Oh, I really think this is going to work. Oh, man, I remember when it was great, but yet turns out to not be great. Like, for me, the one that I'm just not sure, and you can call me an idiot and say I'm wrong about it, but do I really want to be jamming Necropotence on turn 3?
Oh, boy, probably not. You know, you don't get to draw any cards unless you pay life for them, but you can draw them at a little bit faster rate because you can draw as many as you want, as much as you want to pay life for. But in limited, you got to have some really powerful cards to make that worth it, to get that explosion of cards immediately, but then not get to keep drawing cards as normal as your opponent will.
It seems to me like I'd play Necropotence in a reanimation shell. Like, that seems where I can, because I'm going to have something I can hopefully get to quickly, close out the game quickly, and not have to worry about that, the negative side of that.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just looking to set up a combination where it's going to kind of lock up the game for you regardless of if you're drawing cards anymore, absolutely. I think it's that's the kind of home where you want to find it. If you're playing, you know, a black creature deck where your plan is to just kind of attack your opponent with some random guys and maybe kill a couple of creatures along the way, that is not the home for Necropotence. You are gonna have a long, long day ahead of you.
Lee, do you feel, because this one speaks a little bit more towards your damage, you know, core and center that you live on, is Burning Vengeance a trap or is it real?
I think it's real for draft, but probably not for sealed, because for sealed, you're just not going to get, enough of these effects to really make it worth it. But it could definitely be a trap. I think it's a trap in sealed, but if you build around it really hard in draft, I think it can get there. I mean, you've got Wee Dragonauts, so...
I think the retrace cards really help with Burning Vengeance.
Yeah, and there's flashback and retrace cards, right? So
Things like Flame Jab and Una's Grace. You know, when you're flashing back, flashback is not the correct word. When you're retracing an Una's Grace to draw a card and also getting to deal 2 damage out of that, that can be a really powerful interaction that some decks aren't going to be able to handle very well.
My concern and what kind of kept it on my I don't know list was the fact that it's an uncommon in Burning Vengeance. A lot of the retrace, a lot of the flashback are fine cards, but like you said, do you get enough value if you don't hit the Burning Vengeance and get it on the table first? You know, like it's a deck that it seems like you can have it put together. It has to hit right away. And if you're a little bit behind, you're way behind on it. You could potentially can make up for it, say, playing in the same archetype, jamming in Young Pyromancer, you know, to be able to get that extra value.
Open Isochron Scepter, and then you're really doing it, right?
Yeah, then you do it.
Then you're really doing it. It's important to maybe know that a lot of these cards are in here to be reprinted, but they're not necessarily in here to be good limited build arounds. I mean,
definitely.
Char Belcher.
That's the card I was going to bring up. One of the more polarizing Legacy decks, people will play that deck because you can kill your opponent before they even get to take a single turn. And, you know, some people define that as fun, and I call those people jerks, but some people think that's fun. You should probably stay as far away from Goblin Char Belcher in your limited decks as you possibly can. Some people are going to think, you know, oh, I'll flip this amount of cards to it and reveal a mountain and I'll deal a million damage, but you will not. And it's just not something that's going to come together for the amount of mana that you're spending on it. It's not going
to
work for you.
You know somebody's going to be able to make it work with just the fact that nobody can answer it, and they just get to activate it multiple times and get it done.
Oh, they're going
to
kill me with it. I'll get killed by it, for sure.
Yeah.
But I'll be really mad about it.
Yeah. And then I look at elves, and you've got two great elves, right? Heritage Druid and Imperius Perfect, right? Yeah,
two former uncommons that have been upgraded to rare.
Is that's a hole for us, right? I mean, because if you're wanting to draft a great elf deck and all this, and you start with one of them, that sounds amazing to start with a first pick Heritage Druid and just go crazy town off of this. But are you going to get enough is really a concern.
Yeah, I think you're going to need definitely one of the rare elves to get going. And I think you're going to need a lot of the uncommon elves to make your deck
fill out
enough to be able to compete with something like a reanimator deck, something like a green red aggro deck, something like that. You know, if you're just playing some random 2/2s for 3 and something like that, just because they say elf on them, it's not gonna quite work out the way that you want it to. But if you get those payoff cards, you know, the rare that I think you most want to open for this archetype is Imperius Perfect. That gives all your elves +1/+1 and lets you make even more elves all by itself. But that's a rare, and you can't count on getting that. If you open it and first pick it, or, you know, if you're looking at your sealed deck and it's got Imperius Perfect in it, then take a long, hard look at elves. In the common slot, Lissalana Huntmaster is a card that was really, really important for the elves archetype in its original set, Lorwyn. And I think it will remain that way here. Each time you play an elf, it gives you an additional elf, and that can really get out of control, especially if you're making your elves larger through some of the various effects that allow you to do that.
It almost makes me feel like if I'm trying to play elves, if I'm trying to go deep on that, I might actually even have a better time if I'd hit Heritage Druid first. I try to play out the elves to get the mana acceleration, and I'm really playing into something bigger. Say, Regal Force, something like that, that's really going to power it up and be able to go with that.
Now you're talking my language.
And why not throw in a natural order?
Why not?
Just to get everything that you want, right? Just to turn around and do that.
Yeah, you've even got the legacy payoff in those elf decks when you get a lot of mana is Regal Force, and you've got that. You've got Force of Nature, like I had mentioned earlier. So there's a decent amount of large green creatures that you can accelerate into if you get that burst of mana from a Heritage Druid.
There's an elf out there also that plays in Lee's favorite aggressive of your good friend Bloodbraid is back here in all this. So
just the cleanest 2-for-1 there's ever been. Great card.
I've never had any fun when that card was cast.
Against you or with?
Either.
Yeah.
Every time you play it, it's got Cascade, which means you get to reveal cards from the top of your deck until you show a card that costs less than Bloodbraid Elf, and you get to play it for free. So whenever my opponents cast it against me, it seemed like they just hit whatever was the most perfect thing to do at that point. You know, whether I've got two cards in hand and they hit a Blightning to make me discard them, or I've got one creature that's holding off and they hit a Terminate to kill it, And then when it comes to me, I play it, and, you know, they've got no cards in hand, and I'll hit the Blightning, or they've got 11 creatures in play that all can't be targeted, and I'll hit the Terminate, or, you know, I'll be playing some other terrible deck with it in it, and then I'm not having any fun anyway. But
you just need to have Bloodbraid into Shardless Agent into, it doesn't matter at that point.
The only fun that I ever had with Cascade was Enlisted Worm into Bituminous Blast into Bloodbraid Elf. But that happened, I think, one time in my entire Magic career. So,
yeah, this red-green deck, I mean, obviously it has Bloodbraid Elf at uncommon.
They didn't upgrade her.
Uncommon.
Yeah, we're going
to make it. Would you make a case to upgrade? Would you? Is that?
Yes. My goodness.
But, yeah, if you don't want to mess around with drawing cards or throwing trash in your graveyard and you just want to beat the snot out of somebody, take a look at this red-green deck in Sealed or Draft. It's got just a lot of powerful creatures, and it just beats down. And obviously, you have Bloodbraid Elf, which is great.
I think we all know that Lee's going to go turn two Werebear, turn three Bloodbraid Elf, revealing Flint Hoof Boar, and then he's going to play Giant Solifuge.
And get you. Curd Ape. Turn one, Curd Ape.
His opponent's just going to leave his cards on the table and just walk out the door.
He follows it up by Winter Orbing, right? You know, just, yeah, obviously. Just clear as day, right? So I think a lot of people were disappointed when the announcement, when the final reveal was here and the color fixing was a whole bunch of common lands that were just recently printed. But
I don't know what people were expecting. You can't reprint the dual lands. They're on the reserve list. So
I don't disagree with you. Is this enough color fixing to get you into three color decks?
Yes.
So
absolutely. There's beyond the 10 dual lands, there's Prismatic Lens that can help with the fixing, and a couple of different cards of that nature that can help with splashing a color. I don't think you're going to be able to play solid three colors, you know, four of this, four of this, four of this, but, you know, you'll be able to play six of this, and one or two of a third color type of thing.
And some of these lands you're going to play if you get them no matter what, almost, like Maze of Ith or
the
Caracas, if you're lucky enough to get a Caracas. I mean, that's just a strict like upgrade to a Plains, right? You're definitely
going to be so nice.
And the Manland.
Wastelanded.
Yeah, the Factory. I mean, you're always going to probably play a Factory if you have one available to you, I would think.
I mean, if you're some sort of crummy red-green aggro deck, you are.
So there's, it seems like, you know, like we said, there's some pieces missing. There's some pieces that are really there. It seems pretty playable, doesn't it? You know, you just
yeah, totally.
I mean, nobody's got cards yet. Nobody's really shuffled this up. Nobody's really seen how, you know, a draft went great or train wrecked or anything like that. But, you know, so today, you know, 4 days before we can touch cards, this seems pretty all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of fun things that you can do. I think, you know, some people are going to get burned by trying to go too fancy when they shouldn't. You know, somebody's going to build a reanimator deck with one reanimation spell and one giant creature and no way to search for either of them, and they're going to think that reanimator is terrible. Or somebody's going to build the Burning Vengeance deck with one Burning Vengeance and they're not going to draw it, and they're going to cast Una's Grace three times before they die. But, you know, they're the people that are going to, you know, open a sealed deck that's got two Burning Vengeance and, you know, a Chain Lightning and things like this, where they can really get that deck off the ground. Or, you know, when it comes together, I think you're going to have more fun with this limited format than you will with most, because the things that you're doing are so unique and so
powerful too,
kind of over the top, really. That you know. Winning is a lot of fun, and winning big is even more fun.
Wizards seem to design this with some pieces and parts together, some deliberate omissions about some other ideas, like one of the biggest deals, as soon as people saw Animate Dead, World Gorger Dragon, the first question anybody had was, what was the X spell? You know, what can we do with all of our mana and life and things like that?
The answer is nothing.
Nothing right now.
You can ramp out to whatever spells you got in your hand, but they're not going to necessarily just straight win the game like say you could do in Legacy by getting right up to like a blue, you know, a Blue Sun Zenith or anything along those lines and all this. What else have you seen out there that's kind of just unique interactions inside this set?
Oh boy. I mean,
Jesus, so many. Yeah. There's a lot.
Certainly a lot.
It's five color Hondans. Is that like
you can certainly go crazy Hondan control? Something that I tried to do in Standard when they first came out with Enduring Ideal, which some people actually put with good enchantments to great effect, and I was playing my terrible Hondans, and that didn't quite work very well. But yeah, I think there's some real interesting stuff you can do. There's like a black red sacrifice deck, which has been a theme here and there, but not perennial like the blue white flyers and the, you know, red aggro decks and things. But you know, there's a Carrion Feeder, one of my favorite cards from when I started playing, and Mog War Marshal, which lets you make a couple of tokens, and Blood Artist, which really pays you off for having a lot of, you know, creatures that you can sacrifice a lot of fodder for your sacrifice effects.
Blood Artist is one of my favorites. My best showing at a tournament revolved around Blood Artist and playing black-red vampires and zombies.
Yeah, Blood Artist is kind of great. I unfortunately got one of my friends a game loss because of Blood Artist, because I was trying to help and helped the worst possible way. I'll tell you what, one thing, if I had a bucket list, the thing at the top of that bucket list for this set is to put the card Unexpectedly Absent on an Isochron Scepter, because I think that's going to, assuming that fun is zero sum in Magic, that's going to let me have all the fun, and so, my opponent have none of it.
God, Isochron seems abusable. I mean, Memory Lapse?
Oh, yeah.
Put that, doesn't that give you about the same effect kind of thing, only they have to tap, you know, like...
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent...
They can get past two of them. You know, they can get two
spells. Yeah, they can play two spells in a turn, but, you know, it's gonna give you plenty of time to get ready for when they start casting two spells.
You know, things, big bomby things, like the Leviathans and Sphinxes and stuff out there. Like, it seems like if the games go long, it's really going to get dependent upon where that top end is. You know, I definitely see Lee's point of some low-end decks out there and all this, but, God, there's a lot of Wrath in this set. You mm-hmm. know, between just straight-up Wrath of God, Toxic Deluge.
Crater Hellion.
Neverall's Disc.
Oh, yeah.
You know, these
good old Larry Nevin's Disc.
There's a lot out there that can just turn around and play catch-up at the right point in time inside this set.
Void. That's a card that I haven't seen in a long time.
But wow.
Yeah, Void. Void.
I don't know if that's
really devastating.
I don't know.
Or do nothing.
Yeah, I was going to say, that seems like flip a coin. Heads, it's great. And
one card that I'm really excited to play with that I've never gotten to play with before, it was slightly before my time, is Milliken. And that's not, you know, a marquee card. It's not a, you know, shiny button card or anything like that, but it's just a card that I've never played with, that's always intrigued me because of its design, where you get to tap it to add a mana, which is a card that, you know, a lot of creatures do in limited formats that are really powerful. But this one comes with a perceived cost of taking your top card and putting it into your graveyard. But depending on the deck you're playing, you know, if you're playing Reanimator or something, that's something that you really want to do. So something like Milliken, that's an artifact that accelerates your mana. Warren Power Stone, which is a card that I've played with in Cube Draft, which is a kind of fun set, is really powerful there. So being able to ramp your mana as efficiently as this set seems to let you do, I think is going to lead to a lot of fun as well.
I'm interested to see what strategies end up coming out of it. Like you said, this design of where Wizards went with this is real similar to their Modern Master sets. Wizards has come out and now said that there will be one of these Master sets every year, that we will get something different on this. The expectation, no announcement on this, but is that we'll see Modern Masters followed by Eternal Masters every other year.
What about Standard Masters?
Probably enough of those cards available. But
I think they're calling it Eldritch Moon.
Yes, there's some options out there. But when comparing it to those other sets and all this, I think the people that jammed a whole bunch of playtesting right before, you know, the Vegas tournaments, got to try to figure out these strategies. But it seems hard to do this by just looking at it off the website like we have right now.
Absolutely. That's what Lee and I did, and I think gave us a pretty big advantage at the Las Vegas Grand Prix, where there were 9,000 players. We did several drafts the week leading into it, and we discovered that the five-color deck was far and away our favorite and really, really powerful when it came together. And it didn't seem like anybody was talking about it. So on the second day of competition, I went 5-1 in the two drafts by just forcing that both times. And it was wide open and really, really paid off.
I'm going to be really interested to see what comes out of that, to where people build this, where it goes. I mean, we're expecting a tournament turnout somewhere between 60 to 80 players. Our 80s are going to be our cap. We have a real large chance of hitting that cap. It's real popular. You know, the hole to this set is going to be availability. The Wizards is specifically not printing this out to everybody's demands because of the power level of the cards. They're doing it under a controlled environment to make sure that cards don't just crash in value. Because exactly. There's 1 million of them out there, things like that.
Yeah, that's some of the allure of this that you can lose if you print too much of it. If, you know, these cards that are worth, you know, $130 and thereabouts, you know, if you print, you know, too much in this set, it really devalues those and devalues this set because those cards drop in value so much that, you know, it's not as special to open them anymore.
Well, I think they also did a fair balance to the value of what's available and what's expected on this. You know, the unfortunate thing is if they printed all of the most high-end cards possible, because there's several that were omitted from this, there was a lot of things that were brought up that could have been printed inside this set, like Jite was one that I saw, Mana Drain was one I saw.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of cards that could be saved for the next set or anything like this. But if it was nothing but the high-end cards, nobody would ever be able to play it.
Yeah.
You know, store owners would open up all the boxes, would sell off the cards as singles. Like, why wouldn't you? If you just have guaranteed printed money, you know, you take it, right?
Yeah. But that's the thing is you got to – given that they announced that they're going to be doing this every so often, you can't put all of the good cards in the very first
one. In one set, yeah.
Well, I don't think you could put Jite in any of them. Like,
yeah, nobody gets to have any fun when that's
unlimited, not unlimited. Anyways.
Yeah, going back to Magic being zero sum, you know, if you're the one that has Jite in play and your opponent can't answer it, then you're having a lot of fun and your opponent is miserable.
Yeah,
you just print a lot of shatter effects in the set.
No deal.
One card I was really missing that I wanted to see was Port. In this set.
Rishadon Port, yeah.
I didn't because I own two Judge ones. So they went up in value. That was great. But I don't disagree. Actually, I think that's a key card that it seems like an obvious inclusion in a future set. Mm-hmm. There's quite a few of them out there like that are played heavily in the archetypes, can really benefit from a little bit of a reprinting. We see that a lot where there's an expectation of a card coming back in. So when it doesn't get announced, all of a sudden there's a jump in value. Like currently right now in the modern format, Inquisition of Kozilek's are in crazy insane amount of value, where it's a card that everybody thinks they're going to see a reprint on it sometime soon, and it will get reprinted. We just don't know when.
It makes you feel so bad when that was the set that was drafted. I had so many Inquisitions that I would write on the back of them to be a proxy for another card.
Don't worry, it's only like a $30 card.
It's great.
22, terrific. 25.
Yeah. At least I got to pretend it was something worth significantly less for a time.
I never did that, but I also never...
You're very smart.
I never drafted that set, because that was right when I started. So.
Since these Divining Tops that are $30 cards now, I doodled on those, blacked out the background of the top, and those couldn't have possibly been... They flow.
That story is of all ages of Magic, because most people were talking about how they left Wastelands on the table at drafts because they didn't care. Like, the card wasn't there and wasn't competitive in the beginning.
Yeah, back in Tempest drafts, yeah.
And everybody was playing with no sleeves and scratching up their Taigas and their Underground Seas. And
it's my favorite to see the photos from the first World Championships back in 1995, where they're playing with these Power 9 cards and these dual lands, and they're just like bending them and slapping them with their Cheeto fingers on the table.
Their Cheeto fingers.
There's a balance to that. You know, we talk about it in comics the same way and all this. If everybody kept their stuff real nice, it wouldn't be worth anything today. So, you know, and it's an interesting area in Magic that may not be a bad thing, because if things weren't expensive, would more people play? I don't know, you know, or how many people just play the game right now, because you do have some value in the cards that you play with. Mm-hmm. So, I think we're going to sum it up with the idea that this is pretty playable. It looks you know, at the surface and all this, we could be totally, you know, blown out and turned wrong by, you know, the weekend's end. But there's definitely the value inside the set. It looks like it's going to be fun to play. If you get a chance to play in some kind of event like the sealed event we're having, it's a highly competitive event, or we're going to have side drafts going on at the store. These are a time to kind of get your hands around the cards and have some fun with it. You know, it's going to be available at stores in some level, but only for a couple weeks. By that point in time, people will have bought out all the available to just get the value out of it. So
yeah, and I think you want to go in and you want to buy some of this set if you're a collector or a player, because I mean these are cards you're not really going to see again in this in one set. I mean, and some of these rares, like Eric and Keith have mentioned, are very valuable and also very tough to find. So it's a good way to build your Magic collection, and also a good way to get you into maybe checking out a Legacy tournament or you know, filling some of the holes you need for decks in Modern Legacy or even Vintage, maybe.
Yeah, the competitive player in me says that buying packs just to open them for the cards that are inside of them is, it feels so wrong, because financially it's just not a good way to get the cards that you're looking for. It's just not a good idea. I wouldn't recommend it. But this set is different, and I think the value of these cards means that if opening packs just to see what you get out of them is something that you want to do, I think there's a reasonable chance that you end up opening cards that are worth more money than you spent to get the pack in the first place. So if that's something that you like to do, this is definitely the set to do it with.
The interesting point we brought up with all the value and things like that, everything that we talked about value-wise was for the regular card. This set is also printed with...
open a foil.
Every pack has a foil.
Oh, wow.
So this is the same type of thing. And we have some really interesting cards in there that are on the lower end that may be getting their first foil treatment that are playable cards. That's a big deal. You may be having some stuff with some different art, because, by the way, that's something we missed on this completely. There's some of the art on this set is just ridiculously great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have never been a fan of the original Force of Will art, which I know is blasphemy to a lot of people. But, you know, it's a blue card with just the most red art you've ever seen in your life, and it feels so out of place to me. The new art on it, I think, is
miles
amazing.
Better.
Miles. I think it's amazing.
Well, at least it's both Therese Nielsen, right?
Still, yeah.
Yeah, so you get the same great signature if you can find her at an event. The one that kind of stands out to me and is strange because it's a common is Counterspell.
Sure.
The art on that one is just ridiculously great, and to see that in the foil is just going to be really crazy.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's going to look great in foil. Same with a card in the same vein, Daze.
Daze is great. Yeah.
Yeah, the art on that looks really, really nice.
So that can be an extra, you know, just kind of side bonus of finding inside of a pack and all this, because, you know, some things out there like that we're expecting, you know, massive multipliers on. There's really not any good information about that because there's not a lot of it available yet. You know, the pre-sale numbers on, say, like you take Mana Crypt, your top card and all this, about 125 on pre-sale right now. The foils, you know, the only one I see that's available right now is like $330 in a foil. Like that's a pretty extreme hit. You're not going to find it all in every box, but to find something like that is just pretty crazy.
Yeah, if I could open up a couple, two, three of those in my sealed pool, that'd be all right.
Just a foil Chrome Mox or something for you.
Sure.
Wouldn't be
sure.
So bad.
Might as well.
Anything like that that's just going to do you some acceleration inside the game just seems fine, right?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know about you guys, but are there any cards in the set that you are not looking forward to play against? Like, for me, Balance is a card that's always been frustrating to play against for me, and I just... If somebody doesn't cast Balance against me to make me sack four of my creatures and discard my hand, then that would be great if I don't have to go through any of that torture.
Yeah, anything that's a massive swing. Like, those are going to be... We've hit it time and time again. I want to play it. I don't want you to have it.
Exactly.
You know, every single time, it's just gonna go out of hand. I'd love to play Jace the Mind Sculptor and put a couple blockers in front of him on the early turns, and I think you win most of those games.
Start looking at the top of your opponent's deck every turn.
Just all the time, and then, but you know, if it comes up against me, you know, it's what am I gonna do? Like I, you know, you're gonna.
I don't want to get hemmed.
Hemmed to Turok? Like,
just badly hemmed.
Every time you get hemmed,
just two lands.
You're going to discard two random cards, and it's going to be the two lands you need to cast your spells, or it's going to be the only two cards with words on them in your hand when you've got five lands.
Yeah,
I thought you were playing the aggressive deck that's going to turn around and your opponent's got two cards in hand and they're going to wipe your board, and you play Bloodbraid Elf into him. And you're just...
Bloodbraid into him is possible. In this set.
I would walk away from the table.
So that's a sequence you don't want to play against. You want to play.
It's better to give than to receive, and you probably want to be on the giving end of him, not on the receiving end.
There's some big ones in there that I just, you know, you may just not be able to answer. Rorix, like...
Yeah, that guy will kill you pretty quick.
Like, these are cards that close out games.
I imagine there's going to be a game where I'm going to feel very far ahead, and my opponent's going to cast Maelstrom Wanderer and cascade into two other six drops, and I'm just going to wonder where it all went wrong.
That'll be the
why I make the choices I make with my life.
Or can you go turn one in Tomb and then turn two Animate Dead?
It's possible, and that one is going to be a beating.
You're going to have a Sphinx of the Steel Wind in play. I'm going to have this Forest. So at least we both got to have a great time.
Turn two, get what's the biggest creature you could have out? There's no Eldrazi in this set.
No, there's a lot of swings that can happen, and I think, you know, this is a format that, you know, it doesn't have a Grand Prix associated with it, so it's, you know, it's there to have fun with. So I think, you know, you need to go in with the attitude of, you know, you're looking to do something kind of broken, and your opponent is looking to do the same thing. So, you know, if your opponent does something silly like that, just enjoy it with them. Otherwise, you're just going to be miserable because people are going to do stupid stuff to you all day.
It's got potential. The sets out there like that and all that. So,
better to give than to receive.
I would encourage, since we're kind of trying this out, you know, with Magic here and all this, like Eric and Lee are available to kind of come back and chat more and all this. So if you guys have got some feedback, we'd love to hear about it at the shop and all this. Also, Eric and Lee, I know, are kind of getting a little bit more online with their presence here and all this. You guys want to talk about your stream you're kind of getting going?
Yeah, it's really exciting. We've started streaming. We do everything on there: Standard, Legacy, Modern, Draft,
Sealed, everything.
Sealed. Really. We're gonna do every format. We've just kind of scratched the surface on it. We've done only three shows so far, but we're having a really good time doing it, and the response has been pretty good so far too. And we're getting better at it, and just enjoying ourselves. We want it to be entertaining for everyone watching, and also good Magic. You know, good Magic. Making people better, learning decks, strategies, ideas, stuff like that. We're shooting for streaming every Tuesday, somewhere around 5 p.m. So come check us out.
Yeah, where you'll find us is twitch.tv/showtime_MTG. And like Lee said, we'll be on there pretty much every Tuesday. And, you know, if you're listening to this and you've been playing Magic a long time, we've got, you know, some really good insight that I think you can learn from. And if you're just starting out, you know, it's a fun way to watch some people play the game and maybe kind of elevate your team.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different ways to play Magic, as I mentioned at the beginning, but watching quality Magic is something that's really good out there. You can turn around. These guys on their stream are pretty interactive with the chat window, so you can ask a couple questions, see what's what about it and all this, and kind of check it out if you wanted to spy into the world a little bit. Again, this is going to be a little bit more competitive based for what you guys are working on and building for and all this. Which is not bad for even a beginner to watch, but there, if you ever get intimidated and say, wow, that's really complicated and I can't figure it out, there's a lot of different levels of Magic, and everybody's got to start at the lower end in the first place and all this. This just gives you a good insight as to where it can get to on the higher end of some quality Magic. Yeah. So I want to thank the guys for coming out and chatting with us today and all this. Like I said, we are kind of planning on doing this type of broadcast every time there's a new set to talk about. Some of the sets will be in Standard, which are a little bit more relevant towards the everyday player, whereas this one's, again, that high-end kind of set. But we'll look forward to talking to you guys again. Thanks for coming out, guys.
Thanks.